nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so to continue what we are discussing this morning, the topic as kind of ended with was trying to show how with some of these devices with special contacts, with spin, where you can inject and detect spins preferentially, you could do what you could interpret as a spin interference experiment. You know, something where an electron comes in as an x-polarized spin, which is like a superposition of two z-polarized spins, which then undergo different phase shifts. And when they come out here, the current coming out, you know, as an x-polarized or as a minus x-polarized spin would oscillate depending on the magnetic field. And this you could interpret as an interference experiment. And as I mentioned, this is something that's actually been observed in fairly long devices. This is called the Hanley effect. These are observed in long devices at relatively high temperatures. I mean, it's not 4 Kelvin. And the reason I was kind of stressing this point and looking at it and describing it to you as an interference experiment is it brings out these subtleties of phase, dephasing, what it means to dephase, and so on. But there's actually another way of thinking about this same thing, which in a way you might say is easier. And that is to say that, well, when you apply a magnetic field in the z direction, and an electron comes in the x direction, what the electron does is it precesses around the z-axis. It rotates around the z-axis. So what would happen is, as it goes through your device, it will start out being in the x direction, then it will rotate, so it will be coming out of that plane of that screen, and that's why I put an x there to indicate it's now out of, in perpendicular to the plane, because it's rotating around z. And then it will turn to the other direction, and then it will be going the other way, and then again it will come back. So it will kind of go around, round and round that thing. And then you could say, well, now you can see why the current oscillates. Well, because, you get a lot of current when it's polarized in the x direction, then you get a lot of current here. But when it's polarized in the negative x direction, after rotating, that's when the current comes out there. So that would be another way of looking at it. I mean, you might call it a little easier. Now, the reason I didn't do it this way, to start with, was kind of twofold. One is just that I wanted to bring out some of the subtleties of interference and this, how superposition and so on, that physics. The other is that, you see, the way I've been trying to describe this to you, it is like, if you accept this, everything follows. I said that up and down components of a spin pointing in a certain direction are given by this cosine half theta and sine half theta. And if you accept this, the rest will all follow. That's what I say. And point is that the fact that it rotates, it takes some time to show that that actually also follows from this. I mean, how do you know that a spin would rotate around a magnetic field? That's because of other things you know, and that is that what people know about classical magnets. That classical magnets, in a magnetic field want to precess. But that's a whole different thing. And it remains to be shown that a spinner in a Schrodinger equation actually also does that and precesses and obeys what you think magnets should be doing. So that needs to be described, you see. And so that's why I didn't quite want to invoke something that comes from somewhere else. And of course, when you think of the spin as precessing, that kind of brings in particle property of this magnet. If you think of a particle that is precessing. Here, you can call it as a wave property, wave polarization. Okay? And there is always this correspondence. Anyway, so what I'd like to do next is explain a little bit as to why, if you accept this, you can also see why it precesses. That's number one. And number two is, as I said earlier, I have tried to present this so that if you accept this, everything else follows. But I'd like to connect up a little bit as to where that comes from anyway. Okay? Now, one thing I should mention before I go on, and that is that once you understand how these spins operate, you see, there's a lot of in other areas which are not directly related to spins where you can use it also. Because the basic idea is that mentally you can write this two component object, you know, which has got these two components, and mentally associate it with a particular vector. That's the thing that needs to be clear, that when we put it in the Schrodinger equation, it's got an up component and a down component, you know, these two complex numbers, and which are given by this cosine half theta and sine half theta. But mentally, when we say, okay, I've got a spin in this direction, what we're really thinking of is a vector, you see? And the thing is that there is a correspondence between them. You see, for every spinner that you write, there is kind of a vector there. And this is the one that you picture in your mind, the vector, which direction is it pointing? So when you have something pointing in the z direction, the spinner you write is 1, 0. When you have something pointing in the x direction, the spinner you write is like 1, 1, as we have discussed. Then the negative z direction is like 0, 1. And all this follows from that expression I have here. And one little interesting thing you'll notice is because there's a half theta, if you put theta equals 2 pi, you don't quite get back the same thing. I mean, with vectors, of course, you know, you add 2 pi to any of the angles, it's always the same angle. There's no problem there. But here, because it's half, you see, if I put theta equals 2 pi, that's cosine pi. That's really this minus 1, 0. See, that's not 1, 0. So you'd say, well, that means when you have something that's pointing up, it could be 1, 0 or minus 1, 0. Well, that, you see, would cause a lot of problem. I mean, if you're dealing with electric fields, for example, due to light, if you say that electric field is in this direction and you could write it as a 1 or a minus 1, that would be bothersome. Now, the reason it doesn't cause any problems here is all observable quantities depend on psi star. So either one, actually, as long as you're consistent, gives you the same psi star anyway. So that's why this isn't a real problem. But the point to remember then is that, yeah, to every spinner there's a vector, and ordinarily you'd call that the two things are kind of isomorphic, that is, mentally you can associate one with, except that I think the technical term is homomorphic. I just looked it up, you know, I forgot the exact term. Homomorphic in the sense that there's two things that correspond to one thing there, whereas isomorphic would have been, you know, one for one both ways. Anyway, but the thing is that once you understand how this algebra works, it's often very useful. Actually, people who think about light polarization and optical fibers, I've seen papers where they actually work in terms of spinners, you know, to represent the optical polarization in a fiber. And it allows them to do certain things a lot more conveniently. Another example for people in this area that may be interesting is, you know, graphene. You know, graphene, what happens is the unit cell has this two element, you know, A and B atoms. So unit cell has these two atoms. And so when you write the wave function, it has two components. I mean, we are not worrying about spin yet. Without spin, you still have two components, where the two components are the wave function at the A atom and the wave function at the B atom. You know, something totally different from spin. I mean, of course, when you bring in spin, there will be four things. There will be A, B, and then up and down. Long story. But even before you bring in spin, you got two things. And now you can mentally think of that as a spin, as a spin-like thing. You see, and you'll see the literature where they will do that, and they will write things like sigma dot things, where that sigma has nothing to do with real spin. You see? Because once you're familiar with the algebra, you can use it for other things as well, you know, other two-component things as well. You see? So the power of this concept is then this association of, you know, these two component things mentally, you know, with a rotatable quant vector, the kind of things we learned in like freshmen. So what I want to explain a little bit then is this correspondence and how that works. And that is, you see, if you put a magnetic field in the z direction in the Schrodinger equation, then we discussed that what enters the Hamiltonian in the Schrodinger equation is something looking like this. You know, 1 here and a minus 1 here. And as long as it's in a z direction, this has a fairly intuitive structure. You know, the up one, up electron has its energy increased, the other one has its energy decreased. That looks kind of intuitive. Now, if you solve that equation, you see, since it's on the diagonal, basically it is two decoupled differential equations, which you can write down very easily, the solutions to this, that the up one at time t would be whatever it is at zero times this phase factor, mu bbz over ih bar times t. And similarly, the down one will also have a phase factor, but with, instead of a minus sign, it will have this plus sign. That's it. Now, what I claim is that that shows that the spinner will actually be rotating around the z-axis. So how do I see that? Well, again, of course, if you accept this, I mean, right from the beginning, of course, I've said, you know, if you accept this, everything else you can kind of see. Because when phi is zero, that's when this vector is in the x direction. And then as the phi changes, that represents this thing moving in the xy plane. So if I kept theta constant and keep changing the phi, that's like going around in the xy plane. Now you'll notice what is happening here is you're picking up a phase, the up component is picking up this phase, the down component is picking up this phase, which suggests that, you know, it is as if this phi here is equal to mu b bz t over h bar. See? I mean, actually it's phi over 2, which is why I've got the 2 there. That's it. So that solution corresponds to saying that I have a spinner whose phi is continually increasing with changing with time, because that's like the exponential minus I phi over 2, exponential plus I phi over 2, hence the phi moves like that. So you can kind of see why the Schrodinger equation then with a Hamiltonian like that would predict that the spinner is moving in the is rotating in the xy plane, right around that z axis. So, in terms of the vector, as I said, mentally with every spinner, you can associate a vector. And if I write the components of that vector as Sx and Sy here, then I could write Sx is equal to cosine phi, Sy is equal to sine phi. And the equation for S, what I want to show is that if I had to write down a equation for how this vector S, you know, the one that is associated with that spinner, if I had to write down how that changes with time, I'd write an equation like this. And the way I'm saying this is, I'll show that this kind of follows from here. That what we said is, we had a spinner whose phi was changing with time this way. So that tells me that the X component is cosine phi and the Y component goes at sine phi. So if I write the d dt of the Sx, so I'm writing down the derivative of cosine phi, so I basically get a minus sine phi times d phi dt, and minus sine phi is like the Sy. And the d phi dt is a constant, that's this 2 mu b bz over h bar. Now if you look at that equation, you see that's basically the first line of this matrix equation. You know, dSx dt is minus 2 mu b bz dt times Sy. You know, that minus 1, that multiplies the Sy. So in a way, that equation, when you put it in matrix form, kind of goes to that first line. Similarly, you can get the second line. dSy dt, again, that's sine phi. When I take its derivative, I get cosine phi, which is like Sx, and then d phi dt, same thing. That's like the second line of that equation, you see? dSy dt is something times Sx. And the Sz isn't changing, because in this case, of course, the magnetic field is in the z direction, Sz isn't changing. So the bottom line, you know, what I'm trying to show here is that if you start with a spinner and use the Schrodinger equation, what you'd find is that the spinner would be rotating with time, with this angle phi changing with time according to that equation. And mentally, you can associate that with this vector, because you know, the spin, although we write it as a two-component thing in the Schrodinger equation, when we think about it, we think of it as a three-component vector. That's, of course, this thing we are continually doing. The point is to be aware of it. I mean, when we say spin, we say, okay, if you have to spin in this direction. So what you're really thinking of is that vector. But what we are putting in the Schrodinger equation is a two-component complex thing. Okay. And what I'm trying to show then is that the components of that vector would be evolving with time according to this equation, whereas what in the Schrodinger equation, the spinor itself would be evolving with time according to that. Now, this is for the z direction, where it's easy to see. With x direction, what would happen? Let me step back for a minute, and that is that you could actually write this in terms of vectors so that it would apply for any other direction as well. So what I mean by that is what I've written down here is actually like a component of B cross S. So if you write it in vector form, then the advantage is you could use, this would be valid even if the B were not in the Z direction but in some other direction, because then to see all this would take a little longer. But in general, of course, you could do this, you know, whatever is the z direction could be called the x direction. And the general relation would have kind of this form, this vector form, too. And this is a form you'd often see in the literature. And this is what you call this precession, that when you have a magnetic field, the spin precesses around that. So in terms of vectors, that's the equation that tells you this precession. And in terms of spinners, of course, that's how the precession takes place, namely that this angle here, this complex angle here, is changing with time. Another form in which you see this often is that the spin is actually directly proportional to the magnetic moment. You see, the magnetic moment of an electron is this Bohr magneton, QH bar over 2m. Now, H bar over 2 is this angular momentum part. That's what you usually call the spin angular momentum. And then the ratio between them is this Q over m. So the point is that whatever equation you have for the spin, S vector, since the magnetic moment of, and this has nothing to do with chemical potential, by the way, that's mu is just magnetic moment, that's proportional to the S. So whatever equation you have for S, you have exactly the same equation for mu. And only reason this looks a little different from that is because this 2 mu b over h bar is equal to Q over m, which is often called this gyromagnetic ratio and is written as gamma. And how did I pick up the minus? Well, that's because this was B cross S, and I wrote this as mu cross B. So when you turn a cross product around, you pick up a minus sign. That's about it. But those are really all equivalent equations. So anyway, so the bottom line of all this is that this is how we discussed in the morning an external magnetic field would go into the Schrodinger equation. That's an equation that's easy to solve. What it tells you is that when you look at this spin components, its phases would evolve with time in this fashion. This phi's would evolve with time like so, which basically represents a precession around the z-axis. And so if I wrote an equation in terms of that vector, it would look something like this, which in general vector notation would have looked like this. And the corresponding thing for magnetic moment would look like this. And this is the form that you often see. And usually you just put this down without too much discussion. You say, okay, you've got a magnetic moment and in a field, of course, it will precess. But what I'm trying to show here is that it actually is consistent with what we're doing with the Schrodinger equation. Okay. Now, if you had a spin rotation along x, that's a little harder to see in terms of the Schrodinger equation, because now you've got it's slightly different Hamiltonian, but you might expect that will give you basically a rotation along the x-axis, because after all, this matrix would have looked like that if I had used up and down for x as my basis. That's the thing that I went through in the morning, that you could always go into that basis and this would have looked like that. And then you could have shown everything I just said anyway. So finally, the point is that when you have a magnetic field along z, for spinors, it looks like this. For vectors, it would look like that, for the corresponding vector. For x, the corresponding vector would look like this, because now instead of having this rotation around z, which has this minus 1 and plus 1 here, now you'd have the minus 1 and plus 1 here. That's what's kind of the matrix representation of a cross product, essentially. It picks up a minus 1 here and a plus 1 there. Now, the point I want to mention is, if you look carefully, you'll notice one thing, and that is that this matrix, if I call it, say, RZ, in the sense that it represents a rotation around Z, and if I look at this and I call it the RX, the rotation around X, these matrices have this property. Actually, I didn't bother to write down, there is a corresponding one for the rotation around Y. But if you look at those matrices, you'll see it has that property. And if you look at the properties of the matrices we have for the spinors, and you'll notice that because of these factors here, there's a 2 here and an I there. So instead of R, I should look at like sigma over 2i and sigma y over 2i, then it will follow the same relationship. Namely, just as Rx Ry minus Ry Rx is Rz, similarly, the product of these minus in the reverse order is sigma z, which amounts to this. What I'm trying to show is that, you know, what is it that allows you to associate a particular spinor with a corresponding vector? Because that's the very powerful concept in all this, that you've got these two component things and every one of them has a corresponding vector that you can think of. And the important property is that, you see, these rotation matrices, you know, obey this same algebra. So if you actually, like, if you look at any quantum mechanics text, they will usually start somewhere here, the discussion. That is, what they will say usually is that if you want to describe like a two-component thing that you can rotate, if you want to create a two-component thing that you can rotate, the first step is to write down matrices, you know, 2x2 matrices that represent the generators of the rotation group, namely these three things, the sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z, the things that rotate you around x, around y, and around z. Because given that, you can rotate by any angle around any axis. You can create any rotation by a combination of these things. So first step is to write down these 2x2 matrices, and those matrices must have these properties because that is a property of the rotation group. It's a property of the algebra of rotations. If this isn't satisfied, then the rest wouldn't work. So a quantum mechanics text would usually then say, okay, this needs to be satisfied, hence, okay, so how do we write down these matrices in two dimensions? Well, this is one possible combination. There are other combinations. It's just that by convention after Pauli, these are the three that are used usually. And then you'd say that how do I write down an up spin and a down spin along those? Well, those are the eigenvectors of those matrices. So if you want a up and down component along Z, it will be an eigenvector of this matrix. If you want the up and down for X, it will be an eigenvector of that matrix. Now, how do I know that? Well, that's because, you see, the point is that supposing we have, let's say, I want to find the up and down spinors along X. So what I claim is they will be the eigenvectors of that matrix, which will actually look like 1, 1 and minus 1, 1. You can check that, you know, these are the eigenvectors of that 2x2 matrix. Now, why is it that I say those must be pointing along X? Because you say physically you know that if you have a vector in this direction and you rotate it about itself, along that axis itself, nothing should happen to it. So anytime you take an object and rotate it around it, if you take a vector and rotate it around a different axis, of course it will change. But if you rotate it around itself, nothing should happen. And if it's an eigenvector, then the point is nothing will happen, because what it means is that because it's an eigenvector, that matrix times the eigenvector is really just some number times the eigenvector. So what that means is when you solve this, all that happens with time is that this spinor just picks up an overall phase factor in front. Now, an overall phase factor, of course, doesn't change the direction of the spin. In order to change the direction of the spin, you have to do something different to the up component than you are doing to the down component. If you just multiply by some number, it's still the same vector in the same direction. Nothing's happened. So the point is that an eigenvector of that to that won't rotate in an x-directed magnetic field. And hence, you'd say that these eigenvectors must be pointing in the x-direction, and so one is up and one is down. So that's how usually, as I said, in a quantum mechanics text, you'd learn this, that the first step is we are trying to create rotatable objects. Hence, we need these three generators of the rotation group, which must obey this commutation relationship. Now, once you have those matrices, then you say, okay, let's write down the eigenvectors. That will then give you an upspin component along z or minus z, x or minus x, y or minus y. If you wanted an upspin and a downspin along some arbitrary direction, well, then you take sigma dot n, n being your favorite direction, and write down this 2x2 matrix, find its eigenvectors, and those then would be the up and down along n. You see, so that would be the logic from that point of view. What I did, kind of I said, well, if you accept this, rest will all follow. You see, I kind of did the whole thing backwards, you see. I just said, you know, let's take this for granted and then go on for the rest. So now if you look up a quantum mechanics text, I guess, you know, you'll know all this backwards and forwards. Because, you know, you have seen it go backwards. Now you can see how it goes in a quantum mechanics text the other way. Okay, so now in terms of doing real calculations, in terms of actual calculations, of course, as I mentioned before, you know, calculating and understanding are kind of two different things. And in principle, you don't necessarily have to know a whole lot about spins to do some of these calculations, because basically, as I said, the NEGF equations that we discussed last day, I don't need to add anything to it. Whatever we discussed last day is basically the same equations. It's just that all the matrices are twice as big. Why? Because conceptually, for every basis function or every grid point in there, you know, that's this black thing there, it's now become two things, an up component and a down component. So mentally, it is as if every grid point, every basis function is twice as big. That's it. And so all matrices, if you had n by n matrices, they will become 2n by 2n matrices. So from a computational point of view, that's all there is to it in a way. And then the point is how to write down those matrices. Okay. And let me say a few words about how you write down those matrices. But as I said, equation-wise, there's nothing more to add, really. It's all the same equations. It's nothing more to add. Okay. So, for example, I guess yesterday I talked about this 1D model that you write down, where you think of a, in a 1D tight binding model, you usually have this epsilon on the diagonals, and then you have the T's coupling to the nearest neighbors. That's on the upper diagonal and the lower diagonal. Now, mentally, you have to think that every one of those black spots has now become like a red and blue. There's two of them. So every one of these elements kind of becomes like a 2x2 matrix. The epsilon. If there was no magnetic field or anything, the epsilon would become like epsilon I, I being a 2x2 identity matrix. The T here would become like TI. If you had a magnetic field, then of course to that you'd add the mu B sigma dot B that we talked about. You know, because you see, in the morning we talked about with just one point, and now we are trying to translate it to a like a long device. And basically what has to happen is every element has to become like a 2x2. And actually MATLAB has very convenient commands for this, in the sense that there's a command called the Kronecker command, where you can say, take the Kronecker product of this matrix with a 2x2 matrix, and what it will do is take that 2x2 matrix and put it everywhere. You see, epsilon times the 2x2 matrix will go in there, T times the 2x2 matrix will go in there, and so on. So it's actually very easy to program in MATLAB. You don't really have to, you know, it's very convenient, actually. But those things I'll not go into, but the MATLAB codes that I've handed out, you know, if you try to understand them, of course, you'll run into these things and you'll see how it works. Okay. Now, the self-energy, of course, last day also I didn't talk too much about, but here also the way it would work is, you know, I mentioned that if you had a device with three points and you connect a lead to it, then in the 1D, the self-energy function, it looks like minus T to the power IKA, connected to this last point. So it is a 1 and then zeros everywhere and then minus T to the power IKA. Well, now what happens is, if we just had an ordinary contact, then that number would have become that number times the identity matrix, which would be like 1, 1. So at that, instead of that 1, you'd have to put in that matrix there, in a way. If this was an ordinary contact, if you had a magnetic contact which had separate you know, escape rates for up and down spins, well, you then put an alpha there and a beta there as you need it. That's about it. So that's what would then go in there. And you're more or less done. And this again, as I said with MATLAB, the Kronecker command does it beautifully. Now, another one that you run into that's a little harder, and that's a spin orbit coupling. And now, before I talk about the spin-orbit coupling, let me just briefly remind you how we do, say, a 2x2 matrix. What I meant was how you do a 2D device, a 2D tight binding model. and how you choose parameters. This is something I described last day, I mean yesterday. But just to remind you, what I said is that if you have epsilons connected by T's like this, then the EK diagram would be given by something of this sort. It's like epsilon and then minus T times exponential IK X times A for this one, minus IK X A for this one, plus IKY A and minus IKY A. So you pick up these four terms here. So this is given any tight binding model, you can translate it into a EK diagram. Now, as I said, in these talks, I have generally tried to avoid EK diagram issues because, you know, it's this bottom-up viewpoint and EK is something you get when you do this top-down viewpoint. You start from big things. But when you're trying to get some information from top-down things and translate it to a small region, then the thing is the information, of course, is best available in the form of EK diagram. So you might say, okay, now I have a device that's this small. Does this really have an EK diagram? Well, no. But the thing is, if you have silicon atoms arranged in the same way it is arranged in bulk, then when you try to model it, whatever parameters you use should be the same, should be such that if you had an infinite solid, it would have given you the right EK diagram. That small thing, of course, doesn't have an EK diagram. For that, you need an infinite solid. But what parameters I should use? Well, as long as the atoms are spaced in the same way, the parameters you could derive by saying that whatever it is for an infinite solid should give me the right band structure. Okay? So that's the attitude you could use. And then, as I mentioned, this EK in this case looks like this, which if you approximate the cosine with 1 minus x squared over 2, it would become something like this. And if you believe in the parabolic relation, then you'd say, okay, I'll choose my epsilons and t's such that this matches that. Okay. I guess I should have written a t there rather than h bar squared over 2. This should have been t a squared. Anyway. Okay. Now, the Rauschbach term, the spin orbit coupling, it is that in many semiconductors, in addition to the usual, even in the conduction band, actually this spin orbit coupling is really big in the valence band. But in the conduction band, it's small, but in silicon, relatively much smaller. In gallium arsenide, somewhat bigger, that it has to be taken into account. And what it does is to your EK relationship, it adds an extra term that looks like this. This last term here. So in a two-dimensional conductor, ordinarily you'd have this parabolic relation, and this extra term due to the spin orbit coupling looks like this. Now the origin of this is some, like if I have to give it, you know, if I have to describe it in brief, is something like this. We said earlier that in a magnetic field, you have an energy term that looks like sigma dot B that we just discussed. Which means in a magnetic field, we know what to do. Now, the point is that when you have electrons moving in a very large electric field, then it feels an effective magnetic field due to relativistic effects. That is this 2mc, this mc square is kind of suggestive of relativistic effects. And this is something that was discovered, you know, back in the 1930s when studying the spectra of heavier atoms. You see, it becomes important because those electric fields near the nucleus are extremely large. And it was found that this had to be included. This actually goes beyond the Schrodinger equation. It would be a relativistic correction to the Schrodinger equation. You see? Because Schrodinger equation is non-relativistic. So this is an additional thing that had to be included to understand atomic spectra of the heavier atoms especially. Heavier ones because there the nucleus has a much bigger positive charge, much larger electric fields. The effects generally get bigger the bigger the atom, which is why usually for carbon or graphene it would be quite small, silicon somewhat more, gallium arsenide much bigger, etc. Bigger the atom, more important it is. And the thing is, it's a relativistic effect, which is kind of surprising because, you know, usually relativity is something we don't have to worry about much in solids. I mean, usually things don't move that fast, but it really affects the atomic spectra. And there are a lot of, I guess, very observable consequences in solids that follow from this, actually. You know, for example, light emission in gallium arsenide. If you had spin polarized electrons in the conduction band, when they jump down to the valence band, the light that comes out would be circularly polarized. And that is a consequence of the nature of the valence band states because of the spin orbit interaction. This fact that the light that comes out is actually circularly polarized, for example. So there are very observable consequences of this, and it is a relativistic effect, you know, as this MC square kind of suggests. Anyway, so the net result is that even though we have not put any magnetic field from outside, you'd expect a term that would look like, you know, sigma dot E cross K, which, you know, with vector algebra, if it is A dot B cross C, you can write it as B dot C cross A. And I put in the minus sign because I've written A cross C. I've kind of changed the order, so I put a minus sign there. Anyway, so you expect something like this. And in two-dimensional, conductors, there is a very large electric field at the surface, and, you know, because it's right up against the surface. And based on that, what is believed is, you know, there is a term like this, which is what you'd get from here if you put if you assume an electric field in the z direction. Because if it's in the z direction, then what you need is the z component of sigma cross k, which would be sigma x ky minus sigma y kx. So that's like a short 5-minute introduction to where that came from. But you see, there is, of course, enormous literature. People have studied this term, the effects it has on various things, calibrated against experiment. So gallium arsenide, you can look up what this number people believe it to be, etc. Now, here all I wanted to show is that if you had a term like this, how would you put it into our model? And this is where what I'd say is, again, use that same principle that, you know, for this part, I said when you had these epsilons and t's, the corresponding EK relationship looks like this. And what we do is we choose our epsilons and t's so that it matches the correct parabolic relation. Here also same story. We should choose our epsilons and t's so it gives you something like this. So we can go at it backwards now. You see, here we had these cosines, you know, when you do a band structure on a discrete lattice, you get these exponentials, which became a cosine, and the cosine became x squared, because when you approximate with 1 minus x squared. Now, here what you have is a linear term. So that won't give you a cosine. That will kind of be like a sine. Because sine x, because of course this discrete lattice is equivalent to the continuum only for small k's. And for small k's, a sine x is like an x. So if you're trying to get this with a discrete lattice, what you hope to get is something like that. Because if you replace the sine with just kya, then the a will cancel, and then this will become sigma x ky. So I'm kind of going at this backwards. Okay, so it is like this. So what I could try to get is this. Now, how do I get that? Well, I can write the sine in terms of exponentials. You know, I have a sine function here, sine ky. That's like e to the power. That's like this e to the power ky minus e to the power minus ky. And the sine kx is like e to the power ikx, e to the power minus ikx. And now I can identify this one with the connection to the next nearest neighbor in the x direction. That's the next nearest neighbor in the minus x direction, next nearest neighbor in the y direction, minus y direction. And so now I know what to do. That is, the coupling here that I had a minus t, that I should replace with this tx. And that would now be a 2x2 matrix looking like that. The coupling to the y in this direction, which was, again, in the simple case, all of them are equal. Now, of course, these will involve these Pauli matrices. This is a sigma y matrix, that's a sigma x matrix. But you could write these down. So this is how we could ensure that whatever you're using, if applied to a large solid, would have given you the same EK diagram as people believe is right for that material. You see? Okay. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of a feeling for what goes into writing down the Hamiltonian and writing down these details. Because the basic point that I made is, it's the same equations from yesterday, just that everything has become twice as much. And only thing you have to, you know, get calibrated with and get used to is how to write down those matrices. in detail, and I gave you a few examples to show how that works. Okay? And if you go through the MATLAB codes, I think it will get clearer. Now, one thing I want to just mention here then is that, okay, so at every point, it's like a 2x2 matrix. So, this Gn, I had identified yesterday as the electron density. I said this Gn is like it's a matrix, but its diagonal elements are like the electron density. Okay, now if you go to a particular point and look at the Gn, it will look like a 2x2 matrix. If you go to another point, it will look like a 2x2 matrix again. So what exactly does that 2x2 matrix tell you? Well, it tells you what the spin orientation is around that point. You see? Because the Gn is this 2x2 matrix which has all this information about spin right there. And so if you wanted to look at Gn at any point, the wave, if you think in terms of wave functions, there's an up component and a down component. And Gn is this correlation function, which is like a 2x2 matrix, which is this up star, up down star, down up star, and down down star. So this is like the magnitude of the up part, this is the magnitude of the down part. And the off diagonal things have a lot of information. As you know, if something is actually polarized in the x direction, all the information would be actually in the off diagonal terms. And this is again a very good illustration of why, yesterday I tried to explain why wave functions aren't enough and you need correlation functions in general. This is a good illustration of that because, you see, we said that an up spin along z looks like 1, 0. A down spin along z looks like 0, 1. An up spin along x is like 1, 1. That's a superposition of the two. Now, what if you had just unpolarized electrons? Half of them up along z, half of them down along z. Now, if you're thinking in terms of wave functions, you'd tend to add those two. You say, okay, I got one electron whose wave function is this, another electron whose wave function is that, and sure, we add them up and you get 1, 1. Now, that's of course wrong. What we are trying to describe here is electrons which are, have no particular spin preference. If you write 1, 1, what you have written is something that's along the x direction. That's a whole different thing. It's the difference between having a 45-degree polarized light and having unpolarized light. Those are two different things. And the thing is, that difference is very hard to express within a wave function or electric field concept. You kind of have to go to this matrix to express that difference. You see? Even with light, you'd have the same problem. To write down the electric field and how to write down the electric field for unpolarized light. And to explain why it is different from a 45-degree polarized one. So if you actually wrote down the matrices, you can see the difference. So for spin along z, it would look like 1 and then zeros here. For spin along down spin, it will be a 1 here, rest are zeros. For x polarized light, it's like 1, 1. So when you write down this matrix, it's like a half everywhere. Because it's up star, that's half, up down star, that's also half, down up star, that's half, down down star, that's also half. So you got halves everywhere. On the other hand, unpolarized light, that's just the sum of these two. It's got one there and one there, which you could write as, two electrons times a half there and a half there. So that's the difference between x polarized light and unpolarized light. Unpolarized light has no off diagonal components. X polarized one has. And this is the thing that, if you're working in terms of wave functions, you wouldn't know exactly how to say it. You'd have to write a paragraph in English after that, Mathematically, you can't quite express it there. Okay. So this kind of illustrates nicely, why actually you need to go to this viewpoint. Now, if you actually want to extract the spin density, then the way things work is, if you have a matrix for Gn and you want to know what is the spin density along z, what you should do is multiply it by the Pauli spin matrix in the z direction and take its trace. That's this general idea that any quantity you want to calculate, you have to take the trace of that, the operator representing that quantity, and multiply it by this matrix. Now, this is something we haven't discussed much, but we could try to justify this better. But the point I wanted to make is, yeah, if you wanted to calculate spins and all that in detail, you know, how the spin density actually changes, this is what you'd have to do. Go to a point, find that correlation matrix, and take its trace. And then in the z direction, you get a very common sense answer. You'd get A minus B. You say, okay, that's simple. A is the number of upspins, and B is the number of downspins, and I'm looking at just the diagonal elements, taking the difference. Looks simple enough. But if you wanted spin along x direction, now when you do this, what you get is C plus C star. It's got nothing to do with A's or B's. You look at the off-diagonal components and look at the real part of the off-diagonal component. That will tell you how much spin you have in the x direction. And if you want just the electron density, then you just multiply it by the identity matrix, and that's just A plus B. So A plus B and A minus B, those are common sense terms. You know, you got A number of upspins, B number of downspins, so total density is A plus B. Spin density is A minus B. Up to here, you didn't need anything more than common sense. This is the one that, you know, is a mathematical thing that takes time to, you know, get used to and see what it means exactly. Okay? Now, yeah. This part I think I'll just very briefly go over without getting into too much. And this is just that spin current is an issue that has that there's a lot of controversy these days. So it's I'm not sure if one could regard it as settled even. So if you had to write down what is the spin current. So like last day, I said, you know, how you calculate the current. And the question is, how would you actually calculate spin current? Does it mean anything, etc.? And there I'd say that what we had gone through then was, I said, you start from Schrodinger equation and try to write down the rate of change of the number of electrons. And that is how you'd get these two terms. You could call one the current at terminal one, the other the current at terminal two. Now, if you wanted spin current, then the tendency would be to put in a sigma here. That is, you want the spin current in the z direction, so you put a sigma z there. But the point is, you shouldn't put it there. You should really go back one step, put it here, and then take the trace, etc. So these are all things that people are, you know, still arguing about, actually, how to interpret spin current and so on. So this is thing I won't go into in detail because, as I said, I don't have too many good examples to illustrate the thing yet. Okay? As an example, just of things one could do with, one could try to calculate. This is also, again, something, a topic of current research, I'd say, or rather where there is a lot of arguments about the spin Hall effect. And that is, everyone knows about the Hall effect, which is that when you put a magnetic field, electrons want to bend to one direction. So electrons pile up on one side and you have a deficit on the other, and you have negative and positive charges. So actually, if you looked at the quasi-Fermi level, you know, I said before that one way to think about these non-equilibrium things is you look at the occupation, this quasi-Fermi level, what fraction of states are occupied. And quantum mechanically, that means looking at the ratio of this electron density and the density of states here. And you'd see a slope across this thing. I haven't put in any dephasing, which is why there's all these oscillations, because it has these interference effects. As I mentioned yesterday, unless you put in dephasing, you tend to see these. Whereas at room temperature, if you measured, of course, you'd never see any of these oscillations. Now, if you do the same calculation in a material with spin orbit coupling in it, what you find is something interesting. And that is, even if you don't have any magnetic fields and just have the spin orbit coupling, what happens is upspins build up in one direction, downspins kind of build up in the opposite direction. Actually. So if you look at the quasi-Fermi level for upspins, you'd see this blue curve. Whereas if you look at it for downspins, you'd see the red curve. Whereas when you had a pure magnetic field, you know, no spin orbit coupling, you just have one curve because up and down are all on top of each other. You know what? But here, it's as if without any magnetic fields, the upspins kind of bend in one direction and the downspins bend in the other direction. And if you had a combination of those two things, what we believe is you could have something in between, you know, where one of them builds up and the other one is kind of neutralized because for one spin, the magnetic field and the spin orbit add. Now, this is one where, in the last few years, there have been a lot of experiments, except that people usually believe that many of those experiments arise from the properties of the impurities that cause scattering within the channel. Whereas what we are simulating here, what we are describing here is a clean semiconductor. You say no impurities or anything. And what this shows is even in a clean semiconductor, I think one should have effects of this type. Except that those, I wouldn't say, I mean, as yet, that experimentally it's established, really. So there's still an open area. But I was trying to give you an example of the kinds of things you could try to do. So, you know, if you're trying to benchmark, you know, these codes of this type and seeing if you have the spin orbit coupling included correctly and so on. Okay. Now, to finish up then, I want to kind of end on by pointing out something that's, I consider it really a very important development in the field in the last few years. And that is that, you see, of course, all the experiments we are talking about, there are these magnets, but those are basically the two contacts. What are they used for? Well, the property of the magnet is that they have different density of states for upspins and downspins. In any normal material, those would be identical. But in these magnetic materials, they are separated, and often separated by a fairly big number, you know, like a couple of electron volts of that order, see? And that is what allows you to get this different escape rates for two different spins. One spin gets out more easily than the other, and that's what leads to all these spintronic phenomena, in a way. Because, as I said, in order to have these spintronic phenomena, you either the contact or the device must have some spin-dependent properties. See? Now, one thing you'll notice is that in these magnets, the separation, there's this very large number, this 1 or 2 electron volts. It's really quite staggering because if you had to create that kind of splitting by applying an external magnetic field, you know, we said that when you put a magnetic field, the up and down levels split by mu times B. Mu B times B. And if you put that equal to 1 electron volt, the corresponding number for the magnetic field you'd come out with is just out of this world. You know, it's like 16,000 Tesla. If you have any experience with this, you know, 1 Tesla is considered quite respectable. And that's an enormous number. You see? And if you, now question is, where did that field come from? Well, it's not because of because it's a magnet or you've got huge fields inside. Not really. I mean, inside a magnet, the fields are more like 1 Tesla. That's about it, really. So that didn't come from any classical field, you see? And that's believed to be, what's this called, this exchange field. You know, this, I'll try to say a few words about it on Friday, but what is believed is that, yeah, that electrons, the two electrons, in addition to the magnetic field that it feels, there is a much stronger interaction. Much stronger interaction if their wave functions overlap. But you wouldn't have this interaction if their wave functions didn't overlap. So it's a very localized thing in that sense. Wave functions have to overlap. But if their wave functions overlap, then there is a very strong, there can be, you know, very strong interaction whose effective magnetic field is that high, really. And now, one consequence of that is, okay, supposing we had a device where those two magnets are not in the same direction. But, you know, you have one in this direction and this magnet, let's say, injects spins at some angle. Now, then what you'd expect is when these spins come in here inside this contact, they would feel a very strong magnetic field inside this magnet, which is in this direction. And so you'd expect that these spins would start to precess around that magnetic field. You know, this is this thing that in the beginning of the talk, I talked at length about how anytime you have a magnetic field, the spins want to precess. And that's described by this equation. D dt of the magnetic moment is this mu cross B, except that this B is now this enormous exchange field that it feels when it gets in there. So it will start precessing, and this is like a torque, I mean, on the magnet, a torque due to the magnet on these moving electrons. Moving electrons means the ones that came from here and is flowing through this. And the interaction between the magnet and this moving spins is such that overall, if you looked at, you know, this mu, I'm using this mu to denote the magnetic moment of the moving electrons, and m to denote the magnetic moment of the magnet itself. You know, the, and the interaction is such that the total doesn't change. In the sense, it is like the, when two things interact, whatever momentum one loses, the other one picks up. And the total thing, unless there's an external force, the total momentum doesn't change. And this is like angular momentum, where whatever change you see in one, the corresponding, the magnet itself must experience an exactly equal and opposite torque, because d dt of mu plus m is zero. Overall can't change. So what that means is that if you had a device like this, and you had spins getting injected from here, and they get into this magnet, it would feel this enormous torque, you know, due to the exchange field it sees. Now, usually you don't see this if the two magnets are collinear, you know, parallel or antiparallel, because then, of course, mu cross B is zero, because they are kind of in the same direction. So this torque kind of kicks in if there is a little angle to them, as long as there's some angle between them. Then this would be a torque that you would see. And you can see that the moving electrons feel a torque due to the magnet, but by the same token, the magnet itself feels a torque due to the electrons. So those spins are actually exerting a torque on the magnet, trying to turn the magnet. And ordinarily, if you had a big magnet, what happens is it just ignores it. I mean, that's okay. A little push once in a while makes no difference. But when you have a small magnet, then you see that push can actually help flip the magnet. And this is very important because in the past, whenever you had to flip a magnet, you'd actually have to put an external magnetic field to do it. But what has been demonstrated in the last, I guess, 5 years or so with many experiments, is that just with, by creating all kinds of non-equilibrium spins, you can actually push a magnet enough that you cause it to flip, if the magnet is small, of course. So these are small nanomagnets. But the thing is, you can actually flip them just with spins. You don't need an external magnetic field to do it, or external current to do it, really. And this, from an applied point of view, people are very interested in this because, you know, firstly, that you can control it with the current, but more importantly, it's very localized. You know, there has to be this wave function overlap. Because when you're trying to make things small, one of the problems is you put a magnetic field at one place, it tends to spread out and affect other things. But this one delivers the torque in a very localized way, you know, right where you want it. Okay. See? And if you look at the magnetic field you are getting, you see this dm dt, as I said, is this gamma times mu cross B. And the exchange B is proportional, of course, to the magnet itself. So you could write it something like this. So the point is that the magnet actually feels a magnetic field that is, can be written as this exchange field times mu over m. What I mean by that is, you see, exchange, this B exchange, the 16,000 Tesla, that's what these moving electrons are feeling due to the magnet. Whereas this effective field is what the magnet is feeling due to the moving electrons, you see? And the ratio is basically the spin density due to the moving electrons to the spin density due to the magnet, you see? And because this is so large, this can be a fairly small number, and yet the magnetic field would be respectable. You see? So, even if you had, even if your moving spins like had a spin density that was like a millionth of the magnet itself, still the effective magnetic field the magnet would feel would be like hundreds of gauss, and which is usually enough to flip a magnet. That's what, roughly what it takes to flip a magnet, really. See? And so this is, I feel, a very important development in the field. Now, usually in this literature, people don't think of the spin torque, as they call it, in terms of an effective magnetic field. You know, they would say that, you know, you cannot represent spin torque as an effective magnetic field, something else. And the reason is something like this. You see, if you take a magnet and you have some effective magnetic field, then what you expect is that this magnet will want to rotate around that field. As I said, you know, this is the equation that describes how it rotates. Now, if you put a magnetic field, though, it won't rotate forever. What will happen is, after some time, it will come to a steady state. Now, how do you describe that? Well, this equation will tell you it will rotate forever. But what happens in any real system, of course, is there are damping terms. And people know how to describe that in magnets. They have damping terms there. So if you put a magnetic field, for a while it will rotate, but eventually it will collapse and fall in this and come into the same direction as the magnetic field. And that's when it will stop. So with any magnetic field, what you normally expect is that eventually the rotation will stop and it will get damped. Now, the thing with spin torque that makes it kind of special is that people have demonstrated what's called coherent precession. Namely, that if you kind of flood this with spins, you could actually have a steady state situation where the magnet goes on precessing forever and doesn't really collapse to a non-precessing thing. It goes on precessing. And this is something that's, you know, people are studying for using for to make microwave oscillators, for example. Because, you know, it's almost like an oscillator that you just put a DC, no frequencies anywhere, and yet there is one, this magnet that's going on and on, turning around, you see? And this is only possible because this is a non-equilibrium phenomenon, really. Of course, you know, if something keeps turning, the energy has to come from somewhere, see? And this is why usually people would say that you cannot think of spin torque as just a magnetic field. Because if it was just a magnetic field, then eventually the magnet would just turn a little bit and stop. But what we believe is actually you can understand this in terms of a magnetic field. It is just that this effective field itself is dependent on the direction of the magnet. So it is not a constant magnetic field, but rather this non-equilibrium spin that you have is actually a function of the magnet itself. That is what we believe. But this I don't want to get into because, again, this is an area of research where, you know, our understanding is still evolving on all this. But the important message I wanted to kind of convey is that while 5 years ago you would have said that spintronics and magnetics are like two different fields. You know, spintronics is where you manipulate spins. Examples, okay, you have GMR devices that I talked about. There's another version of that called tunneling magnetoresistance, which gives much larger effects. And things like spin Hall. These are about injection, detection, and manipulation of spins. And often, some of them actually involve low temperatures, usually. Although GMR, these are, of course, room temperature devices. On the other hand, magnetics is a whole different industry, you know, very much an applied engineering industry, where you have magnets that you control with currents. And now we have a situation where actually you could use one to control the other, the spins to control these nanomagnets. And that, I think, adds a whole new dimension to this. Firstly, it brings the two fields together, for one. And secondly, you see, with spins, one of the things I've always felt is kind of missing is the equivalent of a capacitor. What I mean is, you know, people say, well, all our signal processing is based on charges, all these circuits. So can you make circuits with spins? Well, with charges, of course, after you have manipulated them and moved them, you use them to charge a capacitor. You store it someplace. With spins, there isn't quite a spin capacitor, you know, where you can actually put the spin there and hold it there. And the magnet kind of does that, you see? Because what it means is you can flood this region with spins, this magnet will sense it, and then depending on how big your spin density is, it will go to some state, one way or the other. So it's a digital capacitor, of course. Digital means it is kind of, it has only two states, so it's not an analog capacitor. But that's nice. I mean, for many applications, that's actually very useful, could be very useful, rather. So I feel that this then kind of adds a whole new dimension to the field, which wasn't there before, where these two things were all separate things. And now it's all kind of coming together. Well, so just to finish up then, to remind you where we are, started with the simple model, went to this quantum transport model. Today I tried to explain what is involved in adding spin to this story. But everything I've talked about so far, or these equations that I showed you, it is kind of based on this Landauer-like picture where there isn't much energy exchange inside. So all the equations in the form I showed you, those would apply. There can be momentum relaxation, there can be all kinds of other relaxation, but as long as there's no serious energy relaxation inside. And all that is assumed to happen at the ends. And often, you know, this energy relaxation could be an important detail or could be a minor detail. But what I feel is, if you understand that well, there are ways to use it creatively, especially in light of all the interest in energy conversion these days, etc. And so what I'd like to do tomorrow is explain some of the subtle issues involved here, you know, in terms of energy conversion and energy exchange. So that's, and I guess in terms of the model itself, we'll take the model we have and I'll explain what changes need to be made in order to handle energy exchange processes. So whatever equations I've shown you so far, assume that all energy exchange is at the ends. Inside, there is no energy exchange. Now, when you have energy exchange inside, how you modify it? So operationally, those are the equations I'll be showing you. But what I'll try to do is illustrate it with interesting examples of what you could do with all this. Thank you.